8:06 on this Wednesday, July 29th. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. We've got 56 degrees here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Erica Martine. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning, everybody. It's meteorologist Erica Martine, and I am tracking a major area of high pressure that's going to build and build and build. So get ready for lots of sunshine. Temperatures for today in the mid-80s. 85 is your expected high temperature. Overnight lows are also going to get a lot warmer. 58 for tonight, and then you could hit 90 for tomorrow, Park City. So keep that in mind. Lots of sunshine in the forecast. Be sure you apply sunscreen often throughout the day. Now Friday, you'll see mostly sunny skies, and I'm just being particular simply because as the area of high pressure builds, or that ridge, we're going to see a little short wave actually kind of ping it a little bit and break it down just a little. So you'll see a few extra clouds move in. Otherwise, lots of sunshine in the forecast. A high of 91 degrees, 91 on Saturday, 89 on Sunday, and keeping it in the upper 80s to low 90s on Monday. So this extended stretch is going to be absolutely gorgeous out there. Please be sure you're mindful of fire weather conditions because it's going to be dry and it's also going to be windy and a little gusty on Friday and on Saturday.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Erica. KPCW News time now, 8:07. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla, talking about new information on the success of the county's mandatory mask order. Park City Manager Matt Dias with a preview of the agenda for tomorrow's City Council meeting. And finally, I'll be talking with Jenny Kirkman with NAMI. She has details about an online class for teens with mental health conditions. Stay tuned. And stay tuned. Coming up on the Mountain Life this morning, right after the local news hour at 9:06, Heber Valley resident Ben Light is pushing his limits athletically. He has completed numerous endurance running races, including 200 milers, a 268-mile winter ultra in the UK, and most recently the Utah Brawl, which we'll hear more about. Then physician, photographer, and artist Eric Overton, a Utah native, he made a documentary film titled Collodion, The Process of Preservation, about our connection to the natural world and the conversations that surround it. All of that, again, coming up on today's edition of The Mountain Life at 9:06. Well, the Snohomish Basin Planning Commission last night postponed a much-anticipated public hearing on the Dakota Pacific project there at Kimball Junction. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports the planning commissioners and county staff deferred the item to their next scheduled meeting, August 11th, when they unexpectedly found that their system for holding the meeting electronically could not accommodate the public that had turned out.
The applicants from Dakota Pacific are proposing a mixed-use project of nearly 1.3 million square feet and 1,100 residences on the property approved for the Boyer Tet Park in 2008. The Snyderville Commission, holding the meeting via Zoom, was not scheduled to make a decision. However, the planners were told early on by their IT staff that the Zoom program, licensed by the county, only allows for 100 participants, and they had already maxed out that number. There was another note of confusion when one resident entered the meeting to comment about the capacity issue, then found she was dropped out of the session and could not re-enter, though she wanted to comment on the Dakota project itself. After a short recess, Snyderville Chairman Ryan Dickey proposed postponing the public hearing with apologies to the applicants. He said they have some egg on their faces, but they are still getting used to working with the electronic meeting system. The IT staff said there is a Zoom program that accommodates up to 500 people, but that license costs thousands of dollars. The staff said they could try to contact the company, get the license, and hold the hearing later on Tuesday's agenda, but planning commissioners noted that chagrined residents were already dropping out of the electronic meeting, and there was not an easy way to notify them later that night. Deputy County Attorney Jamie Bracken also mentioned to citizens that they can send emails to the planning commission following the Snyderville Commission's recommendation. There will still be hearings on Dakota Pacific held before the Summit County Council. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Hi, I'm Julie Hopkins with Keller Williams Real Estate. I love our great community and all the amazing nonprofits that make it the fantastic place it is. And it's a pleasure to support the KPCW Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher to stay up to date on the critical issues facing our community, as well as the human interest stories that are the heartbeat of our town. Real estate information, jhparkcity.com.
The Utah Education Association met in an emergency meeting last night to address concerns about opening Utah schools for in-person classes this fall. The teacher advocate the organization is asking Governor Gary Herbert and the State Board of Education to delay in-person school attendance in those areas where COVID-19 cases are surging. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more on that.
UEA President Heidi Matthews says they came to the decision based on an evaluation of the COVID-19 case numbers and the concern that most districts throughout the state are not prepared to provide a safe work environment at this time.
What are our rights as educators? That was something that I have heard over and over from our people, wondering especially about workload. What does that mean if I'm teaching all day and then I have my online, and how is that manageable? How do we get information about leave? How can we advocate for increasing that? What do we do when people have sick leave benefits, but when they've just been exposed or when they're not symptomatic? How much did it cost all of you to be teaching remotely? And how much did you have to rely on having your home internet and your cell phones? And
Matthews received feedback from association members concerned about compliance and what the terminology means for safe COVID-19 hygiene and distancing guidelines. She says it's unclear if COVID-19 mitigation practices are required or optional. She says that uncertainty puts everyone at risk.
So educator accommodation, educator rights, staffing and compliance. The compliance part I've heard so much about, just some real concerns over, you know, where does the buck stop? That is it the health department? Is it the governor? Is it our local district?
Matthews says many Utah school districts don't have the money to properly ensure a safe in-person return to school. She points out that Utah schools are perennially underfunded, and to add additional protocols and procedures to mitigate the spread of the disease will not be feasible.
That we're calling on the governor to delay the opening of face-to-face schools. Not stop teaching, not stop learning, not stop school. Just delay the opening of the face-to-face schools in buildings until the virus is more under control, and that we have these safety protocols in place, which includes these accommodations, these workplace enforcements, compliance. All of these district plans need to be approved by medical experts and not just any political reasons.
Matthews says the rush to open amid rising virus rates puts students, educators, and families at risk. She feels the best plan is to resume distance learning and reevaluate in-person options later in the fall as case numbers diminish. Before opening schools to in-person classes, she asks that state officials consider employee rights, workplace safety, and equitable learning opportunities for all students. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
It's 8:15. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, Summit County has compiled statistically significant findings that indicate that the county's mandatory mask order is working. On the phone to discuss that and more, I have Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. So you're issuing, or the county's issuing, a press release later today on the encouraging news about the mandatory mask order. What have you found?
Well, very, very encouraging. If you recall, the county council, county manager, and I issued an order about half a week or so before the 4th of July holiday. We had increasing rates, increasing new cases at that point in time. Very concerning. We knew we were heading into a holiday. We thought that a face covering order was the best approach to try to mitigate a surge. And what we're going to release today at 9 o'clock are findings that suggest a couple of things. First of all, the timing with respect to the order being placed to the 4th of July holiday, and then a declining trend that is very clear that there was an impact of the order. We did some analyses comparing the decline in new cases from July 10th. And July 10th, by the way, was a peak, a coincidental peak perhaps, both in the state and in Summit County. And so what we did is we looked at the slope of decline in new cases from July 10th, comparing Summit County to the state, and running it through to July 27th. And we found a very significant difference in the rate of decline. In fact, the p-value for those statistical geeks out there is 0.0002, which is a very strong finding. In fact, if I just share the numbers on July 10th, the state was at 20.56 cases per 100,000. We were at 21.05 per 100,000. Those are new cases. As of the 27th, the state was at 15.36, and Summit County was at 10.6. And I looked this morning, and we are at about 8. So we can continue to see that decline. So I think the take-home message is that the community, residents, and visitors have really responded to this, and that's why it's worked. And so we're very enthusiastic, hopeful that these data are encouraging to the community in a way that will help us all understand that this is working and that we need to continue being vigilant about it.
So how can we say, though, it's the masks and not other precautions that are being taken, like people staying home, people washing their hands?
Well, because the thing that changed is the mask order. There aren't more people staying at home now. In fact, the mobility data suggests there are fewer people staying at home. We have to assume that before June 26th, when we issued the order, and after June 26th, things like hand washing didn't change. What changed is we put in place a mask order. And Salt Lake County did as well, and they've seen similar changes. And so I'm quite confident that that's what made the difference.
And so we have fewer cases, but we're still seeing people get sick. So where's that transmission happening if people have their masks on?
Well, that's a really good question. First of all, mask compliance isn't 100%. But one of the things that we're doing is trying to really hone in on contact tracing. And I've got a little bit of information about that I'll share in a moment. Trying to hone in on contact tracing specific to events, businesses, and generally gatherings, places that we think coronavirus spreads. And as strange as this seems right now, we're not finding any really clear trends. You know, it makes sense that we'd see cases coming from businesses where relatively large numbers of people gather. So, for example, restaurants and bars. But we're not seeing that on a real consistent basis. We're still seeing a fair amount of family spread, so a single case, and then it will spread within the family. We're not seeing a huge amount of travel related. It has increased from virtually zero to about 15%, and right now it's at 8%. So it would be actually quite a lot easier to manage this if we had one area that we could say, okay, this is where the cases are coming from. But it seems to be pretty well spread out throughout business sectors and community sectors.
Okay. And then do we have folks that are doing the contact tracing?
Yes. Yeah, so thank you. We are right now in the process of recruiting 10 contact tracers. We've actually closed the recruitment for that. Incredibly, we got 300 applications. And so we're sorting through those 300 applications. These are part-time, time-limited positions. We're not bringing them onto the county rosters permanently. These are simply to address the surge. And we are funding these positions using CARES money. But we're really optimistic that we're shifting from a place where we had to rely on outside entities to some extent to address both case investigation and contact tracing. We had capacity internally, but just not enough of it, to a place where now I think we're going to more consistently have the capacity internally so that we can hone in more specifically on managing this thing locally.
Yeah. How are we tracking the numbers who have come through for testing? Because I've heard that a number of Florida, Texas, and California residents here in Summit County, are they coming through the testing? And are those numbers getting added to the Summit County numbers?
No, they aren't. The Intermountain folks, we have a weekly call that they've been kind enough to invite our staff to join, and they have their testing crew that runs through that information. It is true that there's a significant number of outside the county individuals coming through those testing centers, but those data are not included in our data. And so they carve out several things. They carve out the location of where the individuals live. And if they're not Summit County, they're not counted as Summit County, either in the number of testing or in the number of positive tests. But they also focus in specifically on percentages of positive tests. So, for example, they may, going through the testing center, the drive-through center, maybe speculatively, let's say they're at 10% positive rate, they'll carve out for us the Summit County specific positive rate, which, by the way, right now is looking really good. It's at about 4%. The state is running at about 10%. That's another reason to be pretty confident in the fact that the masks, we believe, are working. Our positivity rate is much, much lower than the state average right now.
Okay, maybe I missed something. But again, these people from out of state are here in Summit County, shopping at our grocery stores, going up and down Main Street. I mean, they are putting others at risk. So why wouldn't we add them to our numbers? Because they're here.
Well, because they're not Summit County residents. So if they're outside, the only way they'd show up in our numbers is if we know that there was a transmission that occurred from an outside resident. That individual that got that Summit County individual that contacted coronavirus from a non-Summit County resident would be counted as a travel-related case. But that non-Summit County individual that doesn't live here would not be counted as a Summit County case. They'd be counted in their place of residence. That's the only way that you can track it. Obviously, when the data roll up into national numbers, they're counted in the national numbers.
Okay.
And did that clarify?
Yeah, except that if they have a second home and home is here now for the summer.
Okay. So you did not mention second homes. If they have a second home, first of all, they can be here. They own property here. They can be here. There's no limitations to that. It depends on where their primary residence is, though. They will be counted as a primary residence. If they, again, even if they're here and have a second home and it's not their primary residence, let's say it's in Florida, they will be counted as a Florida case. But any contacts that are Summit County residents related to that Florida case would be counted as Summit County cases.
All right, just a lot of other stuff to talk about. Since you and I last talked, there's been a change in the mask order for fitness facilities and yoga studios. A lot of community pressure, I know, from these groups of people put on the county health department. Did you bend to the pressure, or was this the right thing to do, to say that masks are not needed in these fitness facilities and yoga studios?
Well, first of all, the health department didn't make the decision. The Board of Health did, and they're an independent board. I actually believe they did the right thing, and let me explain why. And you're exactly right. We were contacted from both sides, people who didn't believe that the board should make a decision to ease face covering requirements in fitness facilities, and then those that did. And it was pretty clear it was an organized effort. The messages were oftentimes the same. I think those were being driven by the facilities themselves to a great extent, and that's okay. We certainly don't have a problem with that. But what the board did, and in particular, they were looking at Summit County data, but also Salt Lake County data. One of the members of our Board of Health is the deputy director of the Salt Lake County Health Department. I had looked at our own data and confirmed that there had been no cases, no outbreaks that had come from fitness facilities in Summit County. I then reached out to Dr. Angela Dunn, the state epidemiologist, and she confirmed that there had been no outbreaks from fitness facilities in the state of Utah. Dorothy Adams had also investigated what was going on in Salt Lake. And the bottom line is the board made a decision to ease restrictions during exercise, not in the facilities. Masks are still required in the facilities, but once the individual is at their personal exercise space, they are allowed to remove a mask. And so, you know, an example, real visual example of that might be an exercise mat, a yoga mat that is socially distanced, spaced 6 to 10 feet apart. That is a requirement of removing the mask. It's got to be socially distanced. It was quite clear that the fitness facilities themselves were very on board with this. In fact, most of them were already doing all the social distancing and cleaning protocols. And I believe that's one of the reasons we aren't seeing outbreaks coming from those facilities. So what the board approved was that once they're in their space, they're allowed to remove the mask for the exercise bout. Once they leave that space, they have to don the mask again. With that, we've increased our surveillance of fitness facilities, and really the entire state is watching fitness facilities right now because it's counterintuitive to think there are no outbreaks coming from them. But we're not seeing it. We're just not. And so the position of the board was, let's try this. Let's accommodate the individuals who are exercising and especially who are doing strenuous exercise. But let's keep an eye on the cases. And if things change, then we can change and we can re-implement a mask order. We also had a conversation that if there's a significant outbreak from a single facility, it hurts them. And we all know what occurred with our first community spread case this past early spring. And so they understand, they're on board. So it isn't that we've been negligent in this. We are watching it very closely, but we want to be driven by data, and the data suggested this was a good direction to go.
All right. The governor issued revisions to the phased guidelines this week. How did those revisions impact Summit County at all?
Not a lot. There's not a lot of big changes. There are some changes specific to restaurants, a little bit of easing with respect to cleaning. The cleaning requirements were very stringent before, twice a day. Now it's once a day. So the requirements haven't changed. They're still having to wipe down frequently, but they only have to close once a day to clean. There's a few small changes to buffets, but really nothing very significant at all. And as we all know, these guidelines are a living document, and so we expect more modifications to occur in the next week or two.
And I noticed the big tent at the Montage was up with lots of tables pretty close together there. I'm guessing special events happening. How big can a wedding celebration be under the guidelines today?
Well, weddings are hard. For one thing, they're sometimes they cross over to religious events, and those are complicated as well. So, first of all, it depends. I wish I could just give you a single answer, but it depends on whether or not it's an established venue for the purpose of that, whether or not it's indoors or outdoors. But generally, in the phased guidelines, gatherings, including weddings, are 50 or less. For our mask order, we require, if it's outdoors, that individuals wear masks. If it's 50 or more and outdoors, and everybody indoors has to wear a face covering. That's problematic with a wedding, as you can imagine. So we have been working with some venues, trying to hone in mitigative measures to make sure that we can manage this stuff while still allowing for, you know, filming and the vows to be said and all of those different things. So they're complicated. I can't give you a single number. But the phased guidelines indicate gatherings of 50, less than 50 are fine. If it's an established venue, it can go beyond that. If it's outdoors, it can go beyond that. But I do want to stress, several individuals have contacted us, individuals and organizations, about weddings. And what we've seen is an impressive level of cooperation. I think by and large, we're at a place now in this pandemic that people want to cooperate. They get it. They don't want their event and certainly don't want a wedding to be a super spreader of this stuff. And so we found a very high level of collaboration and cooperation. And I think generally things are going well in that regard.
Also, what's the latest about ski resorts opening this winter? I know that you continue to meet with the resorts.
Well, I wouldn't say that we've been meeting. We've been in conversations. I think the resorts are all over this. We've all heard in the news that, you know, the South America resorts have been hit by COVID. Several of them are closed right now. I heard your previous interview and the comment about delaying the opening of schools until fall when the cases are low. That is a concerning comment to me, and not because of the delaying of the opening of schools. I don't have a role in that. But we don't believe cases are going to be low in the fall. We're actually preparing, and we hope we're wrong, but we're preparing for a surge in the fall and the winter. And so I think, you know, the resorts, in fact, I got a call the other day from one of the officials at a resort talking about some plans to reopen. They're being very careful. Obviously, this is their business. Obviously, our economy depends to an enormous extent on their businesses. But we're keeping an eye on it. I will say that they were ahead of us on this this past early spring when we first had our COVID cases and we met with the ski resort officials. They were ahead of us. They said, you know, we know what we need to do. You know, we're going to close. We're going to do it. And so they're great partners. They're great business people. They get this. And they're going to try to phase this in, and we'll see how it goes.
So is it your position still that that we will not get to the new normal until a vaccine is available or we've come up with herd immunity? And how soon could that possibly happen, either of those?
Herd immunity won't happen. It's a myth. I should say won't happen without a vaccine. It's a myth that's being spread out there. But the reality of it is you're not going to get to the roughly 70% without a huge number of deaths. And the only reason, and I shouldn't say just deaths, what we're finding with COVID-19 is that it leaves people maimed. A relatively large proportion, somewhere in the ballpark of 25 to 30% of those that are hospitalized end up with permanent damage. Sometimes that's lung, heart, peripheral nerve damage. You know, this isn't something you want to mess with. So my position in public health's position is we need a vaccine. And the new normal will occur when that vaccine is produced, first of all, identified to be effective and safe, is produced in large numbers and is administered in large numbers. And that's, you know, we keep hearing midwinter. So my own target is that, honestly, I hope to be well into and maybe through the process of initial mass vaccinations by spring. So I think this winter is going to be busy. I'm really hopeful the data look great on the vaccines. But that's when we're going to get back to normal, I believe.
Okay. Rich, we'll look forward to that press release coming out at 9 o'clock then. Appreciate your time as well this morning.
I always appreciate your time, too. Thanks, Leslie.
Summit County Health Director Rich Buller. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. I've got Matt Dias, Park City Manager, online next. Well, the Park City Council meets via Zoom on Thursday starting at 4 o'clock with a COVID-19 update by Summit County Health Director Rich Buller. Also, the council meeting today and a special meeting at 3 o'clock to review and interview police complaint committee interviews. On the phone, I've got Park City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie.
So since I just had Rich on, we'll kind of leave it at that. But did you ask Rich for the update, or is this something that he's doing with all municipalities?
Well, I think all of the above. We tried to obviously stay in regular contact with Rich and his department and staff. And you know, council is appreciative that he's willing to come in probably about once a month and provide us with an update and overview on everything that's taking place. So sort of all of the above.
Okay. Does the council have any particular questions for him or that you know of?
No, you know, I'm not aware of any particular questions. I think, you know, obviously they're, you know, very concerned with just, you know, balancing the needs of our economy and residents and individuals here with the health needs and protecting, you know, what we have and people's welfare and safety. And so I think it's important that they're meeting directly and they're able to spend a half an hour or so, you know, at least once a month and discussing the matters at hand.
Okay. Let's see. You've also got that special meeting today at 3 o'clock, again, with some interviews and then looking at some policies and procedures. But Thursday's meeting at 4:30, there is a public hearing to discuss public safety initiatives. So this is an odd time for a public hearing. Why not at 6 like most of the others that you do?
Well, you know, it's actually in our work session portion of our agenda, but we wanted to make sure, given what's going on across the country and the calls for reform, we wanted to make sure that the public knew that they were invited to the conversation and that, you know, we did want to hear from them. And sometimes that work session part of the agenda can be misleading and people are confused about whether or not they'll be able to provide public input. So at 4:30 on the agenda, the police chief will be speaking to city council about all sorts of initiatives and new policies and programs that are either underway or in progress And we wanted to make really clear to the community that we wanted them to be part of that conversation, and we would be taking public input.
Great. Again, there's about a list of 35 initiatives, including the 8 Can't Wait campaign. We're talking everything from implicit bias training to new policies, such as an officer's duty to intercede if he or she observes another officer using force clearly beyond what is reasonable. Where did these initiatives come from? The department itself?
Yeah, I mean, the department itself has been, you know, in my opinion, this is another time that we benefit from being a resort town. You know, I've had the benefit of working in a large municipality back east in an urban area. And, you know, our police department engenders the trust and confidence of our community, and they're very, very well supported by our city council when it comes to training exercises and training programs. And so a lot of this was actually already underway. And I think, you know, given what's going on across the country, I think our chief and his command staff wanted to come in and shed some light on the progress that they've been making in terms of, you know, working on social equity initiatives. We have a Citizens Academy and a Latino Citizens Academy, and we, you know, conduct implicit bias training. And so they feel that they have been out in front of, you know, a lot of these calls for reform, and they want to share this with, you know, make sure that they share this with the community and then get some feedback along the way. I don't think that, you know, we claim to know it all or claim to be the best of the best, but we have put a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of resources into having a very sensitive community neighborhood approach to policing. And I think our chief and command staff want to share that with council and then want to receive some community input.
Yeah, only about 4 of the initiatives are marked as completed, so it sounds like there's still a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always work to do. But again, you know, I think the stats are in our favor. We have, you know, relatively limited amount of violent crime in our community. But that doesn't mean that we can't improve. We're always, you know, seeking and striving to improve. And I think we're fortunate here in a resort town that we do have resources. And our police department, you know, not only has, you know, quality facilities and equipment, but they also have a great deal of training and policies and implementation programs to try to make sure that we're, you know, practicing best practices and we have the resources that we need, and we're able to be about selective about the officers that are in our department.
Also in work session, a discussion on small wireless facilities in the city's right-of-way. Are we talking, are these the 5G frequencies that many are worried about?
We are, and it's been, you know, a little bit contentious over the last few years as this kind of new technology has made its way to cities and towns across the country. But there was a Senate bill a year or two ago where our own legislature sort of, you know, said these have to be allowed. This is regulated by the Federal Communications Commission. And so at a local level, we get to determine sort of the how and where this type of equipment is installed. And so we've come up with a process, a transparent process, where entities seeking to install 5G would have to come in and determine a location, provide a design, receive a permit. And so we are sort of reporting in, making sure we're complying and conforming with the law, and then also taking public input. I think, you know, although the authority is with the Federal Communications Commission, that, you know, 5G frequencies have to be allowed at a local level, I think we do want to hear from folks. And so that's the item we're discussing.
Well, the city can't deny an application based on the frequency level, but you can deny where they are located.
Yeah, we can try. It's sort of the how and where. And so we obviously are seeking, you know, an aesthetic approach that aligns with our community values. And we have some more stringent regulations that will be implemented in the historic district. You know, conversely, if you're out in a rural area, they might just say, you know, we have no design standards. So we have a fairly rigorous report. There's probably a 30 page design specification sheet. So we put a lot of time and a lot of effort into this to attempt to minimize the impacts, both visually, minimize the impacts to pedestrians, try to use existing infrastructure out on the right of way as opposed to building new infrastructure. There's a host of information in this report that's really interesting.
So based on the city's social equity priority, we can be certain that the locations for these devices won't be determined by socioeconomic status?
I don't know, actually. That's a great question. I mean, that's my understanding, is that you know, there's no reason to site these in just one location over another. You want to put these around the community, so when people are, you know, using this type of technology, they're getting good feeds and quality data, and they want to subscribe to the service. I think just kind of isolating in certain pockets of the community doesn't serve that outcome.
During the regular meeting, Council will get an update on the electric-assisted mountain bike courtesy tag program. Has this already been implemented?
Well, it's about, you know, it's sort of at the ready. We've received a fair amount of complaints this season in particular, but over the last few years from, you know, individuals that are on e-mobility devices on some of our trails that are either 65 years or older or have a mobility issue. And so we've been, you know, getting complaints that people can be pretty chippy on the trails when they see someone on an e-bike, and there have been some complaints. There have been some yelling and some screaming, and so we think that there's an opportunity to have a voluntary tag program. It would be administered by the city, but obviously in conjunction with Mountain Lands, and it's really a council decision whether or not they want to work on a program like this. But it's not too dissimilar than our bicycle registration program that's already offered by the police department. But if you have a mobility issue or you're over 65 years or older, we'd have a voluntary tag program that if someone does sort of accost you on the trail or someone does start screaming at you, you'll have some information, you'll have a tag on your bike, and we think that will reduce some of that tension.
How big is the tag?
It would go on sort of the center pole of your mountain bike. It would be a colorful design, and I think you know, it's probably a little bit bigger than I don't know what comes to mind, sort of maybe the bottom of a coffee mug, that type of thing. So it sort of wraps around the bicycle, and, you know, it would obviously be incumbent upon the driver of the bicycle, if they're the one getting yelled at or they're getting questions, to say, you know, here I'm part of this voluntary tag program, here's why I'm using it, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Also, there's an $8,500 contract. This comes on top of a $40,000 contract that had already been approved to assist with the analysis for possible changes to the city's land management code as it relates to maximum building height and decreased parking requirements for affordable housing projects. So we're hiring these people to look for what? See if the changes are legal and defendable? Or I guess I don't know that I've ever heard that we've gone through a third-party analysis before.
Well, yeah, to take a step back, we're working with a group called Cascadia out of Portland, Oregon. And we've been very, very pleased with the services of this vendor. And this is, you know, phase one, they did a comprehensive analysis of our land management code and our master development process. And they had a number of recommendations for City Council and the Planning Commission. And two of them right out of the gate were adopted, reducing setbacks and open space in order to incentivize community or affordable housing. And there was two remaining, building heights and parking analysis, that were determined a little bit more contentious, a little bit more sensitive, and in need of additional analysis. And so this is that $8,500 change order, is to do that additional analysis on phase two, building heights and parking analysis within our code, about how we could be more flexible with those in order to generate or obtain more community or affordable housing.
All right, and we're finally getting landscaping along Prospector Avenue and Gold Dust Lane. This is 2 years after the project started. So is the project finally finished?
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. You know, sort of finally bringing to completion a business district betterment project in the Prospector area. We have been longtime partners with the Prospector Square Owners Association, and this is sort of the capstone. We had a collaborative grant with UDOT where we did a roadway betterment in terms of crosswalks and bike lanes and elongated sidewalks. And this is finishing it out with the landscaping and irrigation necessary to add sort of the final aesthetics of the project. It's been a long time coming. And a lot of us in City Hall and the Prospector Business Association are really, really happy to be at this point and bring it to completion.
All right. Also, a contract extension for $255,000 for transportation and security during special events. And we have no special events or peak time periods. So what's happening here?
Well, previously we had consolidated various contracts we had in the city to support special events, from parking support, pedestrian support, breakdown, setup, public safety. And we consolidated all these various contracts into one contract and put out an RFP. And there's a provision to extend that contract, and I believe that there's a fall provision in that. And so this is really just a rinse, wash, repeat. We're extending a contract that has a not to exceed amount in it. I don't anticipate, you know, given what's happening with COVID-19, that we would need to procure this amount of services. But, you know, special events can be expensive on the mitigation side of things. And as we've seen, we want to have these services ready and able to support businesses and the vibrancy when we can do so safely. So we are just executing an amendment to a contract to make sure that these services are available. There's no commitment to use them if we don't need them.
All right. And then a special events update. Are we just talking more car-free Sundays and adding, what, 3 or 4 more Saturdays? That's the extent of our special events this summer and fall?
Yeah, by and large. And there is an addendum to the staff report for the benefit of your listeners that shows, you know, all of the work that's been done with the special events department, with the health department, and with event organizers about events that were delayed or canceled or maybe even TBD later this fall. And so it's a really, really nice snapshot of all of the various activities that have either been amended or augmented or changed or canceled. But so staff will be reporting in on the events calendar in totality just to give an update on where we are. And then we do have 2 requests in from the Historic Park City Alliance, our Main Street Association, to extend car-free Sundays further into October. It was supposed to end in August. And then to add some Saturdays on big weekends, such as Labor Day.
Okay. Hey, anything else, Matt, you wanted to mention?
No, that's it. Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it.
Appreciate your time as well. That's Park City Manager Matt Dias. Again, the Park City Council meeting tomorrow via Zoom. You can find out more information at parkcity.org. KPCW News Time now, 8:58. NAMI, that's the National Alliance for Mental Illness, offers what's called a basic class for parents with teens with mental health conditions. Jenny Kirkman has taught this basics class for parents, and she'll be teaching another. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning.
So tell us about the program.
Well, NAMI Utah has seen just a need to offer a lot of services to those that need help, especially during COVID. And so we're excited to offer our NAMI's basics class. It's going to be an online class, so we feel like we can reach more people, and they can take it just from the comfort of their own home now.
And who is it for?
Well, NAMI's basics is for the parents of youth and teens who struggle with mental health conditions.
Okay.
Anyone that's taking care of anyone in their home currently that have a mental health condition.
All right. And give us an idea. I mean, what are they going to get out of the 8 weeks?
Well, I think the most important thing is they offer 3 things. First of all, they offer a great education to anyone in the community about what mental health conditions are. So basically, just an overall education about different diagnoses and how to get help. And second, they offer a great support system. When you go in there, you just feel like you're with other people who are struggling with the same things. So you have a great support. And I think probably most important, you're taught how to advocate for your own children, whether it's going through the mental health system, in the medical field, especially at school, just how to advocate for your children and how to teach those around you about what that is and what your child is struggling with. Gives you a voice in that.
Yeah. So when are the classes held?
They're going to be held in the middle of September. We have not yet a date, but if you go on to namiutah.org, you can click on the basics and sign up to register for on-demand classes. So in the middle of September, they're coming soon. It's all the information about that is on the website
right there. So will they be live or just on demand so that you can, I mean, I guess if they were live, then they're questions and answers, you know, can happen. If
yeah.
It's just an on-demand.
Yeah,
it's
there
just
are. It is a live. It is live. It's the best to take it live. You can, if that doesn't work for you for that specific time, you can go back and take the classes. But the benefit of taking it live is that you are there with other people who are going through the same thing, and they are on there as well. So it's very helpful to see other people's stories and to share in their experiences together. I got a lot of strength from that when I specifically took the class.
Yeah. So tell us your personal background and how you got involved in teaching this class.
Oh, well, when my daughter was 15 years old, she was just going through a rough time. She started to show a lot of signs of a mental health condition, and she started to run away. She started cutting. She tried to commit suicide. And so I was at a place where I wasn't sure where to turn. And my immediately family and friends, I didn't have anyone really to associate that had known that space. So the first thing I did was I went to a support group. So NAMI has support groups. They're family support groups for people who have loved ones who are having had difficulties. So I went there and I just felt extremely supported in that support group and found out about the basics class. I took the basics class with my husband, and I don't know, there's probably 16 other people in the class, and I learned things I had never heard before. I didn't know how to access information. And when I went there to the class, I just felt like I could do it. I felt like I could do it, and like I said before, I began to be able to advocate for my child who was going through difficult things in school.
I mentioned...
And then I became a teacher, and I got trained to become a teacher, and... I think NAMI Utah is not a good, it's a resource that is an amazing resource that maybe needs to have more shed light on it.
I mentioned that this is a program for teens. It sounds like it's something that a parent with a child with any age could benefit from, huh?
Yeah, it is for any age. Just if you are, it's a 6-week class for parents and caregivers who are just experiencing that in the home, that have children who are struggling with mental health in the home. It doesn't matter the age.
All right.
They have other classes. They have a great class that my daughter took. She did amazing. She took NAMI's progression class, and that is for teenagers who are 13 to 18 with mental health conditions. And it's taught by other people, by adults that have had mental health conditions when they were their age and had struggled. And she came out of there so supported by those teachers and other children that were in the class learning about their conditions. It was really helpful.
What's the cost of the class?
Everything is free.
All right.
Yeah, there's no cost to the public. You come away with resources. Everything is, the National Alliance for Mental Illness has been around for a long time, and everything that they have studied and learned, you get in this book, and it's amazing to have all of these resources. So you get not just education, but you come home with, a book of resources of how to move forward in your life. They do ask that you're committed to the class, so you need to have good, attendance and make this commitment. So
okay. Again, people can go online to namiut.org. There's also a phone number I have here, 385-246-5931. Anything else you'd like to tell us about this?
I just think it's a great resource. I was going to say, if you go on the website, there is, just a number that you can call, for mentoring. So if you don't know where to start, you have immediate questions, they're always taking in phone calls. Just get on the phone and call.
All right, Jenny, I appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah.
Jenny Kirk, and again, is one of the educators for the basics class for NAMI Utah. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:56. Well, Park City Film offers virtual screenings online as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to prevent socializing in large groups. However, they have a new series starting this weekend, which raises the curtain for another drive-in movie opportunity and a chance to safely gather with others to see a film on the big screen. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
The annual summer drive-in screening held in the Prospector neighborhood has already sold out, but Park City Film is offering another summer drive-in movie series at the Utah Olympic Park. Director Katie Wang says they've partnered with local events organization Dragonfly Media Technologies. They're bringing in updated technology, which allows films to start before the sun goes down.
Totally kicking up a notch, the drive-in movie experience. They're bringing in an LED screen, which means that we'll have this incredible, quality for the films, but that also means that we can show the films before dark, which is something we've never been able to do before. Normally, you're kind of watching the sun go down and hoping it goes down faster than it actually will, but now we'll be able to show film 7 o'clock, rather, and then again at 9 or 9:30, depending on what film you're talking about. But
they'll have two showings per night with films they think will appeal to a broad range of audiences.
Ranging from films from Teton Gravity Research's new mountain bike film, Accomplice, to a documentary about Shane McConkie, to highly rated films from the Sundance 2020 Film Festival. And we want to remind our communities that films are always better seen together on the big screen, and it's still possible to do that together in a safe way in a drive-in movie experience.
Wang says if looking for films other than mountain bike and ski films, they've selected new and old Sundance movies.
We've got Relic, which is premiered at Sundance, starring Emily Mortimer. It's kind of a twist on the haunted house movie, so very clever, very scary, which is kind of perfect for a drive-in. Palm Springs, which is a rom-com. It was the highest-selling film out of the festival. That'll be Saturday night. And then we have The Big Lebowski, which is one of the cult classics from Sundance 1998.
They'll allow every other parking slot to be filled with a car so social distancing can be maintained. Patrons can be outside of their cars with a mask on, and there will also be some reserved areas for people who want to ride their bikes to the venue. They'll allocate space in the front to smaller vehicles, and the lot will open at 6 6 p.m.
Certainly, you know, you want to get there early if you want to get a prime spot, but you'll be placed within your zone appropriate to your car, so we don't have, you know, some big car blocking the tiny little car behind it. And then for the second screening, and again, it will depend. Some will start at 9, some at 9:30, and we'll open the lot about half an hour before showtime for that film. And then what's nice about UOP is that you've got that long kind of road going up there, so we can queue cars up, check everyone in, you know, print out your ticket and show it to us so it's contactless.
That's Park City Film Director Katie Wang. The cost is $30 per car. A bike spot is $48, and a bike spot can accommodate 4 people. She says that they are also offering free tickets to online workers, so please contact her if you need more information about that. An FM radio is needed to pick up the sound, so an FM receiver is required. We're up to 61 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Forecast today calling for mostly sunny skies with a high of 84, and that's going to be the cool day for the rest of the week. We're going to see highs into the 90s. This is KPCW Park City. Time for news.